the applied side of this is how those various components within the seed have value to some sort of an end user. So for soybean, primarily soybean obviously is processed, 90 or 95% of the soybeans produced are processed into soybean meal and oil. Those each have very different end uses. The oil primarily goes for human use for frying and cooking, salad dressings and things like that, as well as energy sources, biodiesel and renewable fuels. And then the meal fraction goes into feeding monogastric animals.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com. Grow a carbon crop below your row crop. Add carbon to your balance sheet with Loam Bio.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor in Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today, we welcome our guest, Dr. Seth Nave. He's a professor and soybean agronomist at the University of Minnesota. Seth, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's really great to have you here today. And I want to start off asking if you could share with us your path to where you got today, where you've been, what you've done, and also some of the topics you're currently working on.
Sounds good. I actually have a pretty simple path, but, as most professors, I could make this long and circuitous as we like. But really, it's quite a simple story. I grew up in Iowa on a corn and soybean farm there. I was the third male child in my family, and so I didn't think that there'd probably be room for me on the farm. So my plan was to go to medical school or dental school or something like this and go far, far from the farm. But I ended up starting at Iowa State University. Like all of my other relatives, all the family before me and all of my brothers and sisters. And while there, I just decided that I really enjoyed biology quite a lot because that was my core major there. And rather than the zoology part that I was supposed to be focused on, I really enjoyed botany. So I essentially ended up with a botany degree from Iowa State University. And then I started looking for professors to support me to do a graduate school in botany. And the reality was there wasn't anybody that had any money in botany that wanted to hire me on as a master's student. So I crossed the street over to agronomy, visited a number of professors over there, and the one person that was willing to fund my graduate education in agronomy was a fellow named Dick Scheibels. He was a soybean physiologist, and he was willing to put a few dollars behind me and believe in me as a graduate student. So I started working in soybeans with him. I ended up doing a PhD directly through him, and so I worked on. That lab was really focused, interestingly enough, on nitrogen metabolism and photosynthesis in soybean. But Dr. Scheibels really got into quite late in nutritional value of soybean, and he started working on cysteine and methionine levels in soybean. And so that's what I did my work on, is sulfur metabolism in soybean related to cysteine and methionine, trying to improve the nutritional quality of soybean. So I had a fairly basic graduate education in plant physiology, did some quite narrow work on that and graduated and started looking for employment. And honestly, one of the first job openings that came up was at the University of Minnesota for an extension soybean agronomist. And I said, well, I'm a soybean person. I should apply. And I applied, and they gave me the position here in Minnesota. So I've been, I've gone a total of, 300 miles in my whole career, leaving a farm in northern Iowa, going to central Iowa, and then leaving there and, moving 250 miles north to Minneapolis and St. Paul area. So I've not traveled very far in my employment, but I do enjoy traveling through my work now and continue to do those kinds of things as well.
And I guess if you can work find find work to do something you like and enjoy and still be close to home. That's a win-win situation.
For sure. And I wish I could get home to the farm more often. It's just my challenge in my business is that I am a crop scientist and I'm expected to be in the field doing crop related stuff at the same time that my brothers are home busy doing their planting and harvesting and management activities. So it's a little bit cumbersome to actually get back to the farm as much as I'd like, even though it's relatively close. But I think that's pretty universal, is that most people say that the distance to their family doesn't really impact how often they get there. Close or far, usually we all see our family a couple times a year, and that's about it.
That's right. Could you share with us also some thoughts around your current research projects and some of the cool things you're doing currently?
I'll maybe continue on this thread of, where I came from and how I ended up here. And you know, I, as a graduate student working on soybean physiology, I was really doing some relatively basic science in the area, and then came to work at University of Minnesota and was an applied soybean agronomist here. And so started working on those regular things that all soybean agronomists do, populations and row spacing. I did a lot of work with pathologists here around sclerotinia and white mold and those things early in my career, and continue to do a lot of that kind of highly applied production related research. But then along the lines, we do have a protein problem here in Minnesota in our soybeans. Our soybeans tend to be lower in protein than soybeans produced in the central corn belt or in the southern U.S. or across much of South America. And so I started working quite early on soybean quality related issues as part of my job. And honestly, since then, it's really become kind of bifurcated. I have two different research appointments and honestly, two different extension appointments. The simplest way to talk about what I do is I have a whole lab project that's focused around soybean production, soybean physiology, growth and development, yield, minimizing inputs, minimizing environmental effects on our land through soybean production. And then the other half is all related to soybean composition. And those two intertwine a little bit, but in a lot of ways, they're quite separate as well. So I run a soybean quality lab here that we do a lot of quality work for. We do surveys of the U.S. crop for soybeans and soybean meal. We do a lot of commercial work with commercial trials as well. And then I work with the U.S. Soybean Export Council and helping market their soybeans internationally and work with some regional groups here as well. And so that's kind of my extension portion on that quality piece. My clientele is not American farmers as much as it is international buyers. And so I meet routinely with feed millers, animal nutritionists, buyers from some of these importing companies in throughout Southeast Asia, North Asia, Central America, and help describe the quality of U.S. soybeans and some of the value propositions in the trade-offs that we have in quality related to the amount of protein or oil or the amount of amino acids in protein and those sorts of things. Meanwhile, on the production side, my clientele on the extension side is just the traditional Minnesota farmer that most extension agronomists have as their primary clientele. And so I'm meeting with them and working with them on trying to enhance the profitability of their farming operations.
Perfect. And I do want to dive a little bit deeper into the composition topic. So I guess first, could you just broadly explain to us what you mean by soybean composition? And also following up on that, what is it about Minnesota, weather, soil? I mean, what is it about that environment that has a lower protein than what you've seen in other parts of the U.S. and other parts of the world as well?
Sure. I think, you know, the question about composition is really is a fairer one. I think it's a good question to ask because that in some ways encapsulates what I do. I'm interested in the relative abundance of these various components of soybeans. So how much protein is in the soybean seed, how much oil is in the soybean seed, but also within that, how much of the secondary components are there? Is there, how much lysine is there in the protein, or how much cysteine, methionine, or threonine, these important essential amino acids for monogastric animals? Or on the oil side, what affects the fatty acid balance, that those fatty acids that make up the oil fraction? So it's it's how much, what's the composition of the seed relative to those individual things. That seems very academic. The applied side of this is how those various components within the seed have value to some sort of an end user. So for soybean, primarily, soybean obviously is processed. 90 or 95% of the soybeans produced are processed into soybean meal and oil. Those each have very different end uses. The oil primarily goes for human use for frying and cooking, salad dressings and things like that, as well as energy sources, biodiesel and renewable fuels. And then the meal fraction goes into feeding monogastric animals. This is the primary vegetable source, vegetable protein source globally is soybean. This is what we feed our livestock, primarily poultry and swine, but also dairy and other beef as well. And so that protein comes primarily and increasingly from soybean, and that's why soybean is such an important global crop, is that it feeds our animals that feed us. And it provides the fats that we use to cook in, and then also now increasingly these fuels that we're using in our for transportation. So all of those industries require something of the soybean, and they're looking for very specific things within it. Fuels folks are interested in an ideal fatty acid profile for different properties in that fuel, and or salad dressings or mayonnaise. And on the meal side, those feeder operations that are feeding poultry or swine or fish for that matter, that soybean is used as the protein supplement, but the animals don't use protein per se. The animals need amino acids. And, you know, most of us need around 10 essential amino acids that our bodies can't generate themselves. And so those swine and poultry, for instance, need those specific amino acids, and in very specific ratios at very specific times in their life cycle. So mostly we talk about things like lysine, because corn soybean diets typically are deficient in lysine. And so those feeders have to add synthetic lysine into that ration. If we can supply more of it with either the corn or the soybean, that would allow us to reduce the amount of synthetics that are added, and it would provide more value to the end user. So it's a lot of talk here, but what I'm really coming down to is that the very specific profile of all of these primary, secondary, and tertiary components of soybeans contribute to the overall value of that soybean to some end user. So some end user is using our soybean that we produce in Minnesota to feed a broiler or a layer or a sow or a piglet. And each of those different animal species and stages requires a different little adjustment in those relative abundances of those things. And so each different soybean that varies in those various secondary and tertiary components has some different value to that end user. So much of this can be made up with synthetics or with processing, and food people use different processes to affect the fatty acids in our foods, and so do feed millers and others. But if we can identify ideal sets of components and proportions of the various secondary and tertiary components, then that provides more value to that end user. So again, a lot of talk around this, but that's really what we're looking at. And then I think getting at your question is, why are there differences? And there's obviously genetic differences that affect these components. But I'm not a breeder. I'm not focused on the genetic side. I'm more focused on what environmental factors, what environments lead to these variations in these things, and why do Minnesota soybeans have lower protein than soybeans produced in Missouri or Kentucky? Was your specific question? And frankly, we don't know all of the answers, but likely it's due to it's related to nitrogen in some way. And so nitrogen is what makes these proteins in the seed. So more nitrogen uptake, more mobilization of the seed is important to get higher levels of protein. In very general senses, I would say these northern latitudes in the U.S. and southern latitudes in South America have lower protein simply because we don't have a long enough season to either fix the nitrogen with our nodules in the soybeans, take that up and mobilize the seed later, or enough time to mineralize the nitrogen in the soil and take it up through those pathways into the seed, into the plant, and then the seed. So we have an environment that limits us based on that. It's definitely more complicated than just simply a latitude effect, because there's also a longitude effect. We don't have protein problems in New York and Pennsylvania and Michigan that we do in Minnesota and North Dakota. And even at the same latitudes, the protein is much better. What they do have on those eastern latitudes is more rainfall throughout the season. And so certainly rainfall patterns are have a large effect on mineral nutrition in the soil based on availability, mineralization of nitrogen, and then availability of that mineralized N. And rainfall and water patterns play a large role in N fixation as well. So these two things are really driving. So we have a duration of N fixation and N mineralization problem in the north, and we probably have a timing related issue as well. A big problem we have in Minnesota is we have too much water early and then a tendency for too little water later in the season, in a short season. So we have a short season, we have too much water early, we have too little water later, and I think all three of these things coalesce to give us this situation where we just don't have enough we don't have the ability to take up enough and utilize enough nitrogen in soybean.
Perfect. That was very clear. Thanks for really expanding on that. And something you said I thought was really interesting is, you know, there is not a single ideal composition. It will really depend on what's the end use and what is that soybean going to be used for, right? And along those lines, I wanted to ask you, are soybean growers getting a premium or perhaps a discount based on quality? Or is the price for everyone just based on yield and how much that volume or amount of seed cost or is worth?
Yeah, this could be the best or the worst thing about our industry, depending on your viewpoint of this, is that we do not really have any kind of component pricing in soybean, meaning farmers are not compensated for these kinds of value propositions that I'm talking about directly. And so the way our system has evolved is farmers basically, I think a lot of both our psychology as well as the trade has developed in a kind of 50s mentality where American farmers are here to feed the world. We just need to produce as much as we possibly can, dump it at the elevator, and then everyone around the world is begging for our product and wants and needs our product, and we'll take it off of our hands, and we just need to get it out the door. And unfortunately, the psychological part of this still is pervasive in that a lot of farmers still feel that they just need to make more bushels, and that there's unlimited demand globally for it, and somebody will take it. But I think we've been reminded of things like some of the genetic problems, like as early as Starlink and other problems, that when we produce a crop that someone cannot or will not use for some reason, whether it's politically or maybe compositionally, then the value of that decreases. And so that's what we see in soybean, is that we just have these regional variants in pricing that's built into basis, because the soybeans in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, for instance, are distant from markets. And so they have a large negative basis from Chicago price. But the price is actually much larger than the actual transportation would make up for. So the local price includes a ding for low quality in those regions. And that varies year by year based on the variation in quality within those regions. And so this is negative, because it doesn't allow any feedback to the system. Farmers aren't given an opportunity to choose higher protein varieties in a low protein region to make up for this. But on the good side for the farmers is they're not getting directly impacted. They're not getting beat up every time they go to the elevator and getting a discount. I would say that the net economic effect on farmers is probably near zero. It's probably a near zero sum game, is that farmers are paying all of this together in a locally depressed price. And they're all in it together, rather than individuals getting hit or specific counties or regions getting hit. And so probably it's buffering it in time and risk management a little bit. And certainly from a psychological standpoint, farmers don't like to get beat up on pricing and get dockages at the elevators, and would rather it be just a little bit more opaque in terms of the system. But the negative side, again, is that we have trouble making quick effect on this, because farmers aren't given an opportunity to select higher protein varieties. And the seed companies could produce higher protein varieties or protein varieties that had specific amino acid profiles or specific fatty acid profiles. Certainly we have those in Hyalics. But these things go much against our current structure of this massive commodity system that we have, that trades on nickels on the bushel with margins. And so there just isn't room in our system to develop these more highly sophisticated marketing strategies to get these higher value or even slightly incrementally increased value crops through the system to the end user. So when I spoke early, to bring this all the way around to your question, when I spoke earlier that yes, there could be a specific soybean that would be perfect for a piglet and another specific soybean that would be perfect for a broiler, yes, that's absolutely true. But we also accept that it's going to be unrealistic to be moving soybeans from North Dakota to Raleigh, North Carolina, and then from, you know, some other soybeans from Kentucky over into Wisconsin, for instance, for various operations. So we have to use what we've got and best utilize it, but we're also... There's an opportunity for buyers both domestically and internationally to source soybeans that may fit their operation better. And that's really where I'm working with these operations, because many are not given an option. And in fact, when I'm overseas, a lot of the big purchasers, they're buying Panamax vessels at a time, and you know, CHS or Cargill may not give them an option of even a northern or a southern hemisphere soybean. They may just say, here's the price, here's the minimum protein levels. You may end up with a Panamax from Brazil, or you may end up with a Panamax from the US, and you'll find out when you get it. That's where we're at in the market, and we're just trying to help inform them what those differences might be. And if they do get a soybean from a different origin, these are some things that they should expect in that soybean. And these are some things that they can prepare for. And these are some buffering things that they might want to do in their feeding rations to make sure that they have adequate nutrition to supply and have a maximum rate of gain and returns without overfeeding these and over supplementing these diets.
From what you're saying, basically all these buyers, they do have their preferences. They know what would be ideal for them, but they don't really get a chance on the market to purchase those types of specific composition of soybeans or any other crop for that matter that they use for feeding. So it's something that as it gets to their gate, they test it, they see how it fits their ideal composition, and then they try to balance that out within their operation, but not really as a feedback coming from the market already.
Almost 100% right, except I would modify that in the to the point where because they've never been given an option, they don't really they may not even know what would be better for them. And so that's really where we're starting and talking with them about sophistication of their operations is that there is variation out there. And that my feeling, and I'm not an animal nutritionist, but the way they manage risk, their risk management in many of these feeding operations and feed mills is that they supply additional nutrients and feed ingredients like synthetic amino acids to ensure, to be 100% sure that they're not short on anything. And so what they're essentially doing is they're over supplementing these diets because they're unsure what's in that bag that they got from the importer. They're putting this in and they say, well, to make sure I'm good, I'll just add a little bit more. And that way that they can be at 100% feeding efficiency. The problem is the economics of it. And so we're working on those angles with them and helping them try to be more sophisticated, but then telling the supplier that if they want to talk to one of the big exporting companies, the ABCs from the Western Hemisphere, that they should tell them that they would rather have Brazilian or rather have U.S. or rather have Argentine meal for their operations because they prefer that, or they want from a specific port in the U.S. They want P&W soybeans, or they want Gulf of Mexico soybeans. So it's just raising the awareness, and then that will eventually build to a more sophisticated market, we feel. And it's a slow process, and I work heavily with animal nutritionists because they're the ones that speak the real language. But I just bring some of the knowledge of the soybean and honestly the variation in the soybean composition that's important for the discussion.
Perfect. So something that I think becomes an important question here is, let's say that sometime in the future, all this system is going to understand that everybody can win if there is some type of composition / quality market embedded into the yield market already. And let's say that growers eventually will get hopefully a premium, perhaps even a discount, depending on the quality of what they're selling. Is it possible to have high yielding, high quality soybeans in this case? You know, I think in general terms, we think that the higher yield you have, the lower quality you have, although that's not true every time. It's not true for every crop or every condition. But as a general rule, I think that that's a good starting point. What do you think about that applied to soybeans, yield and quality? Can a grower achieve both at the same time and under which conditions?
It is a great question, and I think it's a great thought exercise. I think that we in this business should all be thinking about. I think a lot of us avoid it because we don't think it's realistic, but it's worth talking about. And I'll use a very high-level example of this as a point of discussion for this. Is one argument against this idea is, this came from another famous Iowa State soybean person, Walt Fair, is a famous soybean breeder, a leader in the community. Walt told me one time when I spoke with him about protein level in soybean, he told me, that we don't measure soybean, we don't measure protein in our breeding project because we don't care. We want to increase yields. And if the market wants protein, the way to give the market more protein is make more yield. Because as we know, when we multiply yield times the composition, the yield part of that factor always wins. If you want pounds of protein per acre, it's much easier to get more pounds of protein by increasing yield than it is by increasing the percentage protein. And so he's absolutely right. He can, and that's what the industry has done. They've increased the amount of total protein produced in the world by vast amounts by increasing yields as their primary and secondary and you know, and the tertiary goal in these operations. In fact, again, you know, his breeding operation did not even utilize NIR to test these varieties. They just bred for higher yields. And that's evident in what the varieties are in the marketplace. And that's why we've seen protein levels go down. On the other hand, you know, at some point, we have to look at how those seeds have been utilized. And maybe a lot of this has come through okay. What we've done in breeding in soybean is we've reduced protein levels. Oil levels have basically maintained, and we have more residual fraction. There's more carbohydrate. There's more fibers and starches. Well, fibers and soybeans and carbohydrates and soluble sugars. So that's historically this had no value to the market because corn was so cheap. But now we're in a situation where even the energy of soybean meal has value to the end user. So even though protein is lower, the energy component of soybean still has value to the animal and it's needed. And supplemental energy beyond that in the form of corn or rice or any other supplement in these rations internationally comes at some significant cost. So now we're really looking at the carbohydrate composition of soybean and saying, okay, does it have value? And are these fibers more or less valuable to these animals than these other ones? And so I'm mostly evading your question, I guess, but I'm saying that it is really a complicated one. And I think you could argue both sides of this. I would say there is definitely no free lunch. There's no way around this, but having more, I guess, again, broadly, philosophically, having more input from the market, from those that utilize our product should benefit us rather than just ignoring the end user and saying, you know, shut up and eat it, to ask them what they really want, I think is critically important. And I think we've been doing that. And I think in the past 10 or 15 years of my role in this work, I think that's kind of where we've gotten. And we're, you know, the United Soybean Board is talking about a nutritional bundle now rather than just the protein fraction of soybean. So what else is in there besides just nitrogen that we measure protein on? What else is there? What's the amino acid balance? What is this energy value of the carbohydrate or the residual fraction in that meal? Some of the other value propositions. And I think that's improved us. It's gotten us the right direction. I don't have the right answer for this, but I think we are moving in the right direction. Anyway.
That's great. Really great information. Well, if you're listening to this episode and you're joining this conversation, we invite you to drop us a like, to follow us, also share this episode with anyone else that you think could benefit. I'm definitely learning a lot here. It's been a really great conversation.
It's time for our famous three.
Are you ready to maximize your acres? Discover KWS Hybrid Rye, the high-yielding rye with Pollen Plus technology. Designed for superior growth and resilience, KWS Hybrid Rye helps you achieve greater productivity and profitability. Don't miss out on this innovative solution for your fields. Visit KWS.com today to learn more about how KWS Hybrid Rye can transform your farming practices. KWS Hybrid Rye, growing innovation for your future.
All right, so we're getting towards the end of our episode. We have our last three questions we ask every guest. Seth, the first one here is, do you have any agriculture-related resource that you found useful, that you use a lot, and that you would like to share with our audience?
You know, I'm going to give one that's it's a little bit self-serving. It's one that I don't utilize a lot, but it's one that is definitely underutilized. And that's the Soybean Research Information Network. This is a United Soybean Board funded, supported project to bring all soybean related research information kind of in one house. So the SRIN, S-R-I-N, Soybean Research Info, and I don't know the URL offhand, but everybody Googles everything and finds it just as fast anyway. So Soybean Research Information Network houses research data from research projects supported by the Checkoff, but also extension publications. The group that I work with is Science for Success, a group of soybean agronomists from around the country, more than 20 of us, publish a few white papers and put out some social media posts and do some other work promoting things that are have a national interest to soybean producers. And all of this is, and there's links to all of the other public resources. And I think, I guess I would like to push people that direction because A, it's a soybean-focused research resource. It's a soybean checkoff-focused research resource, excuse me. But it's third, it's also, it ties in across disciplines. It's not just agronomy, but there's connections with our entomology, pathology, and soil science friends across the hallway from us. So it's a good resource, and it's one that is underutilized, and it's probably isn't well known among your listeners.
Perfect. No, this is a great way to actually put this word out as well. Hopefully more people will be aware of it and make use of this great resource. All right, so our next question here is pretty much the same. Like if you have a resource that you like to share, however, outside of ag. So something perhaps more on the personal side, you know, personal development, anything on that side of things.
That's a really good question. I'm not a really good person to ask that question because I don't utilize these things very well. I'm not as well read as I'd like. I want to stay away from all the political angles on this. So I think, you know, I guess what I'd offer is that the most important thing for people today to listen to is their friends and colleagues and family and really stay connected to each other as support networks, obviously, because we all can use more support, but also checks on our own work, our own personalities, our own interactions. I think it's really, really critical that we continue to be open to input from other people in all phases of our life. They're the only way that we're going to better ourselves is through those folks. I think it's great to be able to read individual resources and connect with really bright people around the world. But, you know, there's a lot of really smart people all around each of us every day. They know us better than anybody else. And so that's a good place to start, I think.
All right. So our next and last question is, what types of skills or maybe skill set have you observed in successful people around you?
Well, I have to be a little bit personal with this, is that we lost a really fantastic faculty member in my department. Don Wise was a weed scientist. He was a real pioneer in futurist, I think, his whole career. He spent 50 years at the University of Minnesota, and he was a real futurist in terms of thinking about where agriculture should be. I think a lot of us discounted him because he was so far ahead of where a lot of us were thinking. or where we thought that was possible to go. But he was there and pushed all of us further forward. But getting back to your question, what is the skill? I think the skill that Don brought that was core to him was his ability to organize people. He was one of these children of the 60s and 70s and worked regarding on college campuses during Vietnam War and other critical times to help organize people around very specific issues. And then he brought some of those things to agriculture, and he was not just from the political standpoint, but the pure organizational standpoint. He's a person that was able to identify important people, bring them into his circle, and then affect them so that they could go out and begin to build networks and start large causes. So again, it's this thing that we call organization, and it has a lot of different contexts, and I'm not a student of this at all, but just knowing Don and how he operated and how he could be so successful was all focused around this idea of coming up with good ideas collectively and then organizing the right group to affect change, whether that's politically or financially or within the academic community. So I think if people can figure out how to organize and work with others, and even that skill set requires a lot of sub-skills around human, you know, interactions and interpersonal relationships. But that's, I think, something that that I really, really wish that I had some handle on, just some small percentage of what Don Wise carried in his role here at the university.
I think it's a different perspective on this question that I really enjoyed, because I think a lot of times people think of like maybe more, I don't know, different types of skills. And I think this is the first time that at least a guest that I interview mentions this one. And it's so important, such an important skill to have, especially as you're saying, to have a big change and to have a large impact. It's a key skill to have. So that's a refreshing one to be listened to. All right. Well, Seth, it was great having you here today. Thank you so much for being in the podcast. I really learned a lot with you from soybean composition and management and some of these issues and challenges, opportunities as well that soybean growers can be looking forward to, hopefully, in the future. So thanks for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the invitation. This was a lot of fun. I talked a lot, but I guess that was my job here today. So it was a great opportunity to have a chat with you, and I really appreciate the invitation.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.